Broadcasting live from atop the Rocky Mountains, the crossroads of the West. You are listening to the Liberty Roundtable Radio Talk Show.
All right. Happy to have you along, my fellow Americans. Sam Bushman live on your radio. Hard-hitting news the networks refuse to use, no doubt, starts now. This, my fellow Americans, is the broadcast for February the 2nd in the year of our Lord, 2021. This is our one of two, and our goal always to protect life, liberty, and property, and to promote God, family, and country on your radio and the traditions of our founding fathers. Yes, indeed, ladies and gentlemen, we use the blueprint for liberty, the supreme law of the land, the Constitution for the United States of America as our guide, and absolutely we're convinced the checks and balances brilliantly put in place by the founding fathers, one of the great peaceful restorative solutions we have at our fingertips. As you know, ladies and gentlemen, we believe the checks and balances put in place by the founding fathers were absolutely brilliant and one of the great peaceful restorative solutions we have. I repeat that because I want you to understand that there is hope in the future, ladies and gentlemen. I want to be very clear about that. I know we live in perilous times. I get it. I know things seem dismal. I understand. But we also reject revolution. We stand for peaceful restoration of the greatest country on the face of the earth. Now, normally, I do a recap of the previous show. I'm going to skip that today. We'll talk about that later in the broadcast or maybe get to that tomorrow. We've got such a, in my opinion, an interesting guest that I want to give the whole hour to this guest. His name is Joseph Lozito, Joe Lozito. You may or may not have even heard of him. This is the story of how I went from being an average Joe to being dubbed the New York City subway hero. It's Joe's story. The New York subway hero, my battle with evil, and the spree killer. It's a paperback that was written in 2014 by Joe. Joe also, believe it or not, does a podcast called Coliseum Chronicles. And the penalty box is the nickname, Coliseum Chronicles, the penalty box. You can find it on Podbeam and on podcast platforms everywhere. And the focus of the show is hockey. It's talking about enforcers who have played for the New York Islanders organization. Available, of course, on all major platforms, etc. But here's the deal. Joe was just an average Joe. Pardon the pun there. Living his life, living the dream, if you will, living in New York City. And man, one day it all ran off the rails. I think it was 2011. We'll get into the details in just a second. But before we do, Joe, welcome to Liberty Roundtable Live, sir.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate you taking an interest in the story, sir.
Thank you very much. Now, let me ask you this. Let's talk about your life a little bit before all this went down, because I know your life has never been the same since. But tell me about Joe. Growing up, who you are, what, you know, give me kind of a sketch on Joe, will you?
Yeah. I grew up in Queens, New York, which is one of the boroughs outside of Manhattan. Just regular upbringing, you know. My dad went to work. I was born in 1970, so grew up during the 70s. Dad went to work. Mom stayed home and raised the kids. You know, as I got older, we moved to Long Island as a teenager. Again, nothing. I lived a very nondescript life. I always tried to just keep my head down and just go about my day, go about my business. And later on in life, I met the woman of my dreams, and we got married, have two wonderful kids, and basically the reason I breathe and the reason I live is for my wife and my kids. Really, to be honest with you, nothing else matters. So the average Joe is the perfect phrase for me, because I always say I'm just a regular guy with one good story.
All right. How'd you get so into hockey?
I've been in Queens back then, there weren't too many ice rinks out there, so we did a lot of street hockey and everything, and played a lot of street hockey. I was always one of the younger kids on the block, so I played with a lot of the older kids, and just grew up a big Islanders fan, and you know, I appreciate the physical side of the game. I appreciate the fighting that isn't really there anymore. And when we moved to Long Island, I grew up, you know, was 14. We were about 10 minutes from the Nassau Coliseum, and I say I grew up in that rink. I got to know a lot of people with the organization, a lot of the players, and it just grew from there. So I like hockey and football and you know, combat sports. So,
all right. Speaking of combat sports, you watched a lot of MMA fighting as well, right?
Yeah, I'm proud to say that. I guess one of the advantages of being an old man like I am, I'm 50, is that you get to see certain things from its infancy. You know, nobody around today is going to say they saw the first Major League Baseball game or anything like that. But I am proud to say, thanks to my friend Dean, I have been watching the UFC since day one, and I always credit it with having a hand in probably saving my life.
Wow, reality TV at its best, huh, sir?
Maybe.
Well, it turned reality for you one fateful day. When was this, 2011?
Yeah, it was February 12th, 2011.
All right, you wake up, you're what, going to work, normal day?
Yeah, normal Saturday morning, and actually, to correct one thing you said, at the time I was living in Philadelphia.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, I love Philadelphia. I mean, I haven't been there in 10 years, but we really liked it down there. But, you know, the opportunity to make more money was up in New York, and it was the best thing for my family. It bugged me a little bit, my commute, because it took time away from them, but financially at the time, it was a sacrifice I had to make, so... it was just a regular Saturday morning, and take my commute from Philadelphia to New Jersey, jump on the train in New Jersey, and that takes me right to Penn Station. That's 34th Street in New York City. And then from Penn Station, I take a subway, which is normally about a 5-minute subway ride, and it drops me off basically across the street from my job. That day it didn't go as smoothly, though.
All right, we'll get into that in a second. What would be your job in these situations? What were you doing?
Well, I still work, even though I haven't worked since May, thanks to some people that run the city and the state. But I work at Lincoln Center. Lincoln Center, I think people think, is one building. It's actually a campus where we have buildings dedicated to the New York City Ballet, the Metropolitan Opera, New York Philharmonic. So I work in David Geffen Hall, which is the home of the New York Philharmonic, and I do box office work there.
And you've done that for a long time then?
Yeah, I've been in the business since 2005. I actually got my start at Madison Square Garden doing the same thing. And this opportunity came up in 2010. And it's been a blessing because I work with some really great people. And it was a good move for us financially. And, up until last May, it was one of the best things that ever happened to me.
And when you had your experience on the subway, which we're going to dig into hard as we start the next segment, but did they give you any grief at your job related to all the fanfare related to this?
No, God, no. Lincoln Center was my boss, in particular, my colleagues were very supportive, and Lincoln Center as a whole, as a company, they were amenable to pretty much anything. They understood the severity of the situation. I also understood that it was a big news story. So they were wonderful. I can't even begin to thank them enough because they handled everything great. They understood everything, and they were wonderful.
Let me tell you why I wanted to do this story and why I consider you an American hero, Joe. And I know that, it's going to be difficult for you to respond to this because, what do you say to people that are saying that kind of stuff, right? I mean, I get it.
Yeah.
However, it's one thing to take down a subway thug and stop the crimes. It's another to get beat up really, really, really bad in the process and survive. It's another to carry on as you have done. But to have the attitude of gratitude and appreciation for life and for your wife and your children and your job and the people around you, and not have hatred in your heart, but to have respect for police officers in general, et cetera, when you've been so wronged on so many levels, it to me is the American hero story, Joe.
Well, like you said, I don't thank you. I don't really know what to say about that. I never look at myself as a hero. The whole New York subway hero thing, that was something created by the media, and I used it in my book because, maybe like the eye catcher type thing. But I don't consider myself a hero. I really just consider myself a guy that was put in a position one day and I had to respond. And I'm just blessed that every day that I wake up is another gift. This February 12th will be 10 years. And to me, I've been given 10 years of gifts every day that I get to wake up and be with my family. So, like I said, they're the focus of my life. So I could be dead. So I do have a lot of gratitude for the fact that I am alive, and that I've had so much support from so many people. So it's my opportunity to say thank you, maybe to a larger audience being on your show. And I really appreciate everybody that has ever sent me a note or a tweet or a text or anything. It really means the world to me.
or, ladies and gentlemen, by the book, incredible education about our circumstances in life, especially in New York City. We're talking about the New York subway hero, My Battle with Evil and the Spree Killer. It's a book written in 2014 on Amazon now. Check it out. Get your copy today. So, Joe, are you a religious guy?
I believe. I don't. For me to say that I'm a religious guy, I think would be doing a disservice to the people who actually put in the work and go to church and Sunday and maybe do stuff for the church. I'm spiritual, maybe put it that way. I definitely believe in God. I believe in higher power. And if I ever had any doubts, that day on the subway would have really squashed those doubts, because I 100%, I believe there was a higher power looking out for me that day.
All right, when we get back, I want to learn a little bit more about your wife and how you met her and how she's dealt with a lot of this. Because you know what? We can hear from Joe all day, and we will, and that's great. But I want to know your wife's perspective. Maybe others haven't been able to cover that as much, and I don't really want to, you know, give her too much focus and put her in an uncomfortable situation. But I do know that it takes I'll tell you this. It's harder for me to see my wife suffer or my kids suffer than it is for me to suffer, right? That in mind, when we come back, I'll have you respond to that if you don't mind, Joe. Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about Joe Lazito, or Joseph Lazito. We're talking about the story of how he went from the average Joe to being the subway hero. But in my opinion, now we're talking about a national hero due to how he's lived his life since so many tragedies have occurred. We'll talk about it on your radio.
You know where the solution can be found, Mr. President? In churches, in wedding chapels, in maternity wards across the country and around the world. More babies will mean forward-looking adults, the sort we need to tackle long-term, large-scale problems. American babies in particular are likely going to be wealthier, better educated, and more conservation-minded than children raised in still industrializing countries. As economist Tyler Cowen recently wrote, quote, "By having more children, you're making your nation more populous, thus boosting its capacity to solve climate change. The planet does not need for us to think globally and act locally so much as it needs us to think family and act personally. The solution to so many of our problems, at all times and in all places, is to fall in love, get married, and have some kids."
Have we realized the assault against our lives, our liberties, our faith? To defeat this assault, Christians and all people of goodwill should have strategies to prevail in our faith and principles, which are simple. No need for a complex formula. One goal, one aim. A strategy like the heroic Christians of the past. We win, they lose. Nothing less. Big Q, Little Q. The Calm Before the Storm, by a friend of Medjugorje. The strategy of heaven revealed. Big Q, Little Q. The Calm Before the Storm. Available on Amazon.com or by calling Caritas in the U.S. at 205-672-2000.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, riding shotgun on the show today, Joe Lazito went from the average Joe to being the New York City subway hero. That's the way the media calls it. But in my summation, Joe's a hero, one, for saving his own life and stopping the thug when the cops didn't have the guts to do it. But more importantly, how he's lived his life since. That's what really intrigues me, his attitude of gratitude and appreciation for life and for those around him. And you know what? We are going to hear from Joe and his side of the story for sure in detail. We'll let him walk us through all that. But tell me about your wife's experience through this whole thing. You've been married to her for a long time, right?
Yes. Going back to the hockey aspect, I met my wife at a hockey game, at an Islanders game, now it's a Coliseum. We've been together since 1992. We've been married since 1997. She blessed me with two sons, and I've told the story about that day I don't know, it seems like a million times in the last 10 years. And it's funny, I give a lot of harrowing details, and none of it ever really fazes me. The one part that always fazes me, the one part that always gets to me, is the part where I have to call my wife in the story, because I'm calling her from Bellevue Hospital in New York City, and she's at home in Philadelphia with my kids, who were 10 and 7 at the time. And that's the part that always gets to me, because I'm in the hospital, but I'm not actually there to support her and protect her. And now she has to make the drive up from Philadelphia to New York, and she has to be with my kids, and they have no idea what they're walking into. They only know that I was involved in this fight with a guy with a knife, and that I was stabbed several times, but they don't know what they're walking into. And out of everything I will tell you, and I've told everybody, none of the details about the fight or the stabbing or the betrayal gets to me. But when I talk about my wife and my family, that's the one part that always chokes me up and, you know, gets me emotional, because I feel like I wasn't there for them that day. But, look, I don't know how everyone else feels. I kind of feel like women are magical, because they make human beings. I mean, their bodies are made to reproduce, and
the right kind of women are magical, that's for sure.
Yeah, and they keep the species going. Like, as much as I want to do in life or whatever, I can't make people. And you know, my wife blessed, like I keep saying, my wife blessed me with two sons, and to me she's just the most amazing woman I know, not just because of that, but you know, to me they're magical. They keep the species alive. Like, I can't stress that enough. And you know, I always say she's the backbone of the family. She survived. To me, she went through what I went through, even though thankfully she didn't have the physical wounds. But like you said, I think it's a good analogy. She had to see me, see the aftermath of what I went through. She had to be there for me, which of course she wants to be. But she also had to be there when everything happened afterwards with the court system. So, you know, she had to live that with me. And like you said, sometimes it's more difficult to see someone you love go through something than actually go through it yourself. So she laughs when I call her the backbone of the family, but I 100% think she is.
She laughs because she doesn't know how to respond, and she knows it's true, and we all know it's true. It does take a man and a woman in God to become whole, so there's no doubt about that. As she was driving to the hospital, did she know how bad you were?
No. Basically, what she knew, because what happened was that while I was in the hospital, the detective called her. She didn't pick up the phone. She was working that morning, and it was an unknown number, and we generally don't pick up unknown numbers. So I said, let me have the phone. I called her, and I told her, and at first I think she thought I was just telling a sick joke, to be honest with you. You know, sometimes I say stupid things or whatever to try to get a laugh out of people. And I think at first that's what she thought I was doing. And when I finally told her, I said, look, take a breath. This is for real. And I told her what happened. I always say I heard the life just drain out of her. And she basically had to go home and pack a few bags and, you know, grab my kids and head up to New York. So she knew, all she knew going up to New York was that there was an incident on the subway. I was stabbed 7 times, but that I was okay. So she knew that I was okay. I didn't have any damage, say, to like my heart or any my spinal cord, my brain, whatever. So she knew that much, but she had no idea what she was walking into. And, you know, unfortunately, my wife does suffer from anxiety, so that even adds more to the story. But I think the part that I get proud of, not only for my wife, but, you know, she always talks about my kids, who, like I said, were 10 and 7 at the time, and they handled it so great. They were basically, they spent the whole ride almost being adults, telling her, you know, try to calm down. You spoke to daddy. He said he's okay. He sounds okay. So just try to breathe. And like, the whole situation is just such a source of pride for me, the way that everybody handled it. So, you know, it's that, like I said, that's the one part of the story that always gets to me.
All right. How bad were you, Joe? How were you close to death? How bad did it get?
Well, I lost a lot of blood. So I don't know how close to death I was. I know that when the paramedics finally arrived and they put me on the stretcher, I passed out. I never lost full consciousness because I heard everything that was going on around me, but I did pass out. I did lose a ton of blood. And like I said, I ended up getting stabbed 7 times. I got stabbed 3 times in the head, 1 time in the face, once in the knuckle, once in the thumb, and once in my tricep. So you talk about God, and I always say I'm blessed. I mean, one of the wounds in the back of my head, maybe 6 inches lower or however many inches lower, he hits me in the spinal cord and I'm paralyzed. And then there's no question that I'm not here talking to you today. So, I think I was in pretty rough shape, to be honest with you. But I guess that's for the doctors to decide. But it felt like I was near death, that's for sure.
All right. So the guy's name who committed these horrific crimes, how do you say it, Maxim Gelman?
Maxim Gelman. I guess it's a hard G.
Maxim Gelman. All right.
Yeah.
And he basically killed 4 people in Brooklyn the 24 hours or 48 hours before Joe ran into this criminal. I guess he killed 4 people in Brooklyn. And then he met you in the subway. Nobody else really stopped the guy or even tried, right?
Well, he did kill 4 people. He brutally murdered 3 of them with a knife, and he carjacked a few cars during his rampage, and he just plowed over a guy, and he died instantly at the scene. So those were the 4 murders. It was a 28-hour killing spree, and aside from the murders, he did carjack 1 other person, I think. He attacked 2 other people, and then that morning is when I ran into him. I mean, he literally ran into me, and he basically came up to me and challenged me, and that was it, and then it was on. But I don't know the circumstances of all the other incidents, but I don't think there was ever, let's say, a confrontation in terms of a fight going both ways. I know in all the incidents, it was pretty much one way where he dictated the events, and then everything happened, and it led up to our showdown on the subway.
All right, now you're kicking back, going to work, making all these transitions, long haul from Philadelphia, if you will. How did you get singled out, or how did you get face-to-face with this guy?
Well, I think it was a geography thing. I think the common belief is that he wanted to take over the subway. What he was going to do after that, I have no idea. But for people that aren't familiar with the subway, if you've been on a train, it has 10 cars, 12 cars, whatever it is. And I was in the front car, the very first seat. And to just sort of give you a picture idea of this, I was right behind the motorman. So basically, the motorman is in his compartment. It's a small steel compartment where he drives the train. It's the steel wall. And then on the other side of the wall is where I was sitting. So I don't think it had anything to do with me in particular. Maybe in a bigger scheme it did. But I think just on the surface, I think it was more of where I was sitting and everything that happened that day. Because he actually tried to get into the motorman's booth before the attack. He wanted to get in there, and he was rebuffed. So I think if it wasn't me on the surface, I think it would have been anyone that was sitting where I was sitting.
How did it happen then? Most people got mowed down. How did you decide to fight? What was kind of the moment? Was it a decision for you? Was it a natural reaction for you? Was it you had the choice to bail or engage? You thought, what was your thinking? Give me kind of an understanding.
Yeah, so basically right before the confrontation, he was standing over me. He was probably 2 feet away from me. I was sitting down. He was standing up. He reached into the back of his jacket, pulled out this 8-inch knife and said, "You're going to die. You're going to die." And he plunged it right under my left eye. So I'd like to say at that moment, I formed this master plan and I knew what I needed to do to take him down and disarm him. But honestly, it was reactionary. I guess on some level, I knew I had 2 options. I could either just turtle, cover up, or I could fight back and try to survive, and that's what I did.
Hang tight. Joe Lozito with me, ladies and gentlemen. He considers himself the average Joe, and I guess that's true. A family man is the average Joe in America. He's not seeking for power or politics or fame or fortune or anything. He just wants to be left alone with his 2 sons and his lovely wife. But he stood up. Like we all need to do in America, ladies and gentlemen. Hang tight. More with Joe in seconds.
Your daily Liberty Newswire. You're listening to Liberty News Radio.
USA Radio News with Dan Naraki. group of 10 Republican senators sat down with President Biden at the White House Monday evening to begin negotiations over a COVID relief package. During the two-hour session, the senators laid out their $618 billion counterproposal to the president's $1.9 trillion relief package. Senator Bill Cassidy is a part of that group that went to the White House, and the Louisiana Republican tells CNBC that there should be some optimism that a compromise can be reached.
There was common ground that we've got to take care of the American people. The president said, listen, we may disagree on some things, but we're not going to disagree on the need to take care of those in need. Now, Republicans offered for something more focused, but another bit of common ground is that we're talking from data. What does the data show that we need? And the president's going to have his staff get back to us, and we'll kind of compare our data points. That's good news.
This is USA Radio News.
Here's some great news. If you missed the deadline to sign up for health insurance, or more importantly, if you sign up for a plan that you're just not happy with, you still have a choice. It's called MediShare, and MediShare is a Christian healthcare sharing program. It's been around for 25 years. They have more than 400,000 members now around the country. And get this, over the years, MediShare members have shared more than $2 billion of each other's medical bills, so they could help share your needs too. And best of all, you could save a lot of money with MediShare. The typical savings for a family is around $500 a month. Your savings could be more or less, but think about what you could do with that extra money every month. So if you think you're stuck with a high-cost health plan that doesn't have much to offer, think again. You can join MediShare anytime, so call them today and check it out. There's no pressure. They're super easy to talk to. 833-34-BIBLE. That's 833-34-BIBLE. 833-34-BIBLE.
January was the deadliest month of the pandemic in the U.S., with more than 95,000 deaths from COVID-19 recorded. Dr. Anthony Fauci believes things could still get a little worse, but the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases tells CNN that he sees some light at the end of the tunnel.
It is conceivable that things could get a little worse. What we're starting to see, which is a good sign, is that we're starting to see a plateauing of the numbers of cases, which will always be followed by a diminution and a plateauing, and then ultimately a diminution of hospitalizations as well as deaths. But still, even if it plateaus and starts to come down, we're still at a very high, disturbing level. But hopefully, we'll continue to see a downtrend. So if we continue to abide by and use and implement the public health measures together with an increasing number of people who get vaccinated, I hope we can get a trend that will continue to come down lower and lower.
This is USA Radio News.
I want to dedicate this song to Mr. Rupert Murdoch.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, Maxim Gilman was the criminal. And he killed four people in Brooklyn before slashing at Joe Lozito in the subway. The time frame is 2011. What was it, February the 12th, sir?
Yes, sir.
It was an average morning for Joe, long haul to work from Philadelphia. Joe was sitting down. The thug was standing up and said, in an evil hiss, "You're going to die. You're going to die with that." Joe's normal commute to work turned into a nightmare. He stabbed Joe in the thigh. That's how it all started. You had a decision to cower and let him just beat you up, or to try to get away, or to fight. You naturally chose to fight. Did you do it to stop him from getting other people, or did you do it out of self-defense, or obviously both? But what drove your reaction?
I guess the easiest thing to say is if you take the knife out of it, if someone comes up and punches you in the face, you're going to react. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, I would be lying if I said I did it to stop him, because I think I was the only one on the train that day that I had no idea about what he had done in the prior 28 hours, because it wasn't a story yet in Philadelphia. So while it was a story in New York, and I know that there were people on the subway that knew exactly who he was and knew exactly what he had done in the prior 28 hours, I had no idea. To me, this was just a guy that was coming at me. And so I didn't know what he had done. I didn't find out what he had done until I had actually reached the hospital. And while they were checking me over for wounds and everything, that's when I was told what he had done. So at this point, it's just a fight to me. It wasn't that, you know, I wasn't trying to be any sort of hero or anything like that. To me, it was just the guy coming at me, stabbed me. So it really was just reactionary. And like I said, I think subconsciously I knew I had two choices. I could cover up and let him have his way with me and carve me like a turkey, or fight back. And I still may die, but I don't know if people are getting tired of hearing me say this, but I have too much to fight for. I have my family here, and I definitely wasn't going to go down without a fight. So that's what I did. I decided to try and fight back, and fortunately, I'm here to tell the tale.
All right. Now, you, obviously, he tried to get into the motorman's box. He was rebuffed, so they knew. I don't know if they hit the 911 button, if they knew who this guy was, if they were in New York and knew the story. The cops, obviously, over the last 28 hours, were aware of the killings that have already taken place, and they were searching for this guy. Back up from the story. Now we've heard your kind of perspective. Hey, you just engaged because you had to. But what about all these other people? Where the heck are they, sir?
Well, Sam, just to clarify something that might blow your mind and maybe blow the minds of your listeners. Because he had done all this in the prior 28 hours, a woman had phoned the police at 96th Street Station because she had seen him. He actually approached her and told, and as she was reading an article about him, and he knocked the newspaper out of her hands and said all of this was a lie, and thankfully he didn't touch her. Well, she ran up to street level, called the police, and they sent probably hundreds of officers down into the subway system. So the person that actually rebuffed him from going into the motorman's compartment was actually an armed, uniformed New York City police officer. There were two of them in there with the motorman. Gelman didn't know he was speaking to the police, but the police definitely knew who Gelman was because he was the reason why they were on the train. So he thought he was having a conversation with the motorman. He was actually having a conversation with the police. So they were right there, and they witnessed everything go down from the safety of that box.
If they knew who he was and if they were sent down there to find him and stop him and they had an interaction with him, why didn't they stop him, sir? I'm not very smart.
The only thing I can say is that they're gutless and that they're cowards, but I can't confirm that. If we get into the aftermath, he was made out to be a hero by New York City and by the police department and their union, but I think everybody knows the actual truth as to what happened. It's right there in photos. Everybody can see who actually ended up in the skirmish with him, and it definitely wasn't the officer there, but I don't know, stage fright, whatever it is, maybe having a gun and a billy club and mace and the act of being able to surprise someone wasn't enough to give this man the bravery that was required in that moment.
What did you have for the fight, Joe? Nothing?
I had my hands and my hard head, I guess.
Okay, so, but what I'm saying is you didn't have anything to prepare you for this except for your life and maybe playing hockey or whatever and just a will, right?
Yeah, that's it. I had my hands, my hard head, and my will to not die.
Wow. Yeah. All right, so how long did this skirmish take place, and what was everybody else doing on the train while that was going down?
Well, I always laugh because it actually takes me longer to talk about the actual fight than the actual fight, length of time it took. It was probably 45 seconds to a minute. I mean, he did I give him credit. He did the maximum amount of damage in the minimum amount of time, that's for sure. He's very handy with his knife. And all I can say is about what other people were doing, because obviously I was solely focused on the task at hand. I can only tell you that before the fight happened, it wasn't a particularly crowded subway because it was a Saturday morning. But it was, I would say most of the seats were filled. And once the fight was over and I got up, I looked and most of the seats were wide open and most of the people had either scurried to the other end of the car or moved into the next car. So that's what they were doing. And just so everyone understands, I don't really, I don't blame any of them. I mean, this is
no, but hold on. I do though. No one came to your aid, sir.
Well, one person came to my aid in the aftermath. His name is Alfred Douglas, and he's the one that I always credit with saving my life and being the actual hero of the day. But in terms of helping me in the fight, no, nobody did. But again, I think a lot of people on the train knew who he was. They were probably just terrified being in the same car with him to begin with. And I think there's a lot to be said for that. Maybe I was lucky in that sense where I had no idea who this guy was. and you see this guy wielding this 8-inch knife, and he's, and you know, there's blood everywhere, and maybe, you know, I don't blame anyone. There's nobody on that train aside from the two police officers that I really hold accountable for it. I mean, just an average person like myself that felt the need to run to the other car or run to the other end. I don't really, I don't hold any animosity or ill will to them, because it's not, you know, I think I was put in a situation where I had to make a decision, and I think everybody else on the car were put in a similar situation, and maybe they chose what was best for them. So personally, I don't have any ill will towards any of them.
How did you get him stopped then? If he's handy with his knife, if he's slicing you up pretty good and everything else, how did you get him stopped?
Well, like I said, he stabbed me first in my face, under my left eye, in my left cheek. And as he brought his arm back to stab me again, there's a move in wrestling, like college wrestling, called the single leg takedown. And basically, it's exactly what it is. You go for the legs. I mean, it's the easiest way to get someone down. If you do it successfully, you go for the legs to try to take them down. Now, although I watched several hours of MMA at that point, I never actually trained. So I guess instinctively that's what I went for. But having no training, I went in too high, and I actually ended up wrapping my arms around his waist, and it ended up being more like a football tackle. So while I was able to tackle him and get him down, that's when he actually did the most damage, is when he stabbed me the three times in the head. And those were my three worst wounds, the deepest wounds. But like I said, he was very handy with that knife. And even though I got him down and I was on top of him, he was still trying to stab me. And that's when he stabbed me two more times while I was on top of him with the knife, because he's right-handed, so am I. So he's flailing up at me with that knife, and I'm trying to catch it with my left hand. And I missed him the first two times, and that's when he got me those two times. And finally, on the third time, I was able to catch his wrist, and I slammed his arm down, and the knife came out. And that's when the cops came out of the motorman's compartment, right after that.
So they just sat there in this compartment, yeah, sir, after they had already engaged him and chose not to take more aggressive action. They watched this whole thing unfold and sat there?
From the safety of a locked steel door, yes.
These people belong in prison for a long time, sir.
You would think that, but the city later on gave one of the officers a commendation for bravery. And the story that they tell is better than fiction, believe it or not.
Now, here's what's fascinating to me. You know, Americans are getting sick of the cops. Some are even going so far as calling the Blue Plague. Mm-hmm. I don't go there because I'm a member of the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association. Mm-hmm. In fact, not only am I a member, I'm the vice president of operations. And so I believe in the police. I get that there's some bad apples there and there's some cowards there, and I'm ashamed of that. But I, as a whole, believe in law and order, and I do believe in the proper role of a sheriff and the proper role of police officers. I think most of them are good, great, wonderful people that put their lives on the line every day. So I believe differently, but it's no wonder that we're starting to get this view of the police with that kind of cover-up and that kind of dishonest defense, Joe.
To me, the more heinous part of it is above the police, not the actual individuals, and we could discuss that further if you like.
It's coming up in seconds, ladies and gentlemen. I'm telling you, the story is riveting, and I don't understand it. I just don't understand what happened after. You would think that people would want to do all they could to protect and do all they could for Joe. But not in government sometimes, ladies and gentlemen. Not when cowards are on the line with authority, right? Hang tight. Joe Lozito with me.
The Foundation for Moral Law is a nonprofit legal foundation committed to protecting our unalienable right to publicly acknowledge God. The Foundation for Moral Law exists to restore the knowledge of God in law and government, and to acknowledge and defend the truth that man is endowed with rights not by our fellow man, but by God. The foundation maintains a twofold focus. First, litigation within state and federal courts. Second, education. Conducting seminars to teach the necessity and importance of acknowledging God in law and government. How can you help? Please make a tax-deductible contribution, allowing foundation attorneys to continue the fight. You may also purchase various foundation products as well at morallaw.org. Located in Montgomery, Alabama, the Foundation for Moral Law is a nonprofit, tax-exempt 501c3, founded by Judge Roy Moore. Please partner with us to achieve this important mission. morallaw.org.
The spirit of the American West is live and well in Range Magazine, the award-winning quarterly devoted to the issues affecting the American West. Each issue contains informative articles, breathtaking imagery, as well as the culture of cowboy spirit today, and gift ideas like the 2021 Real Buckaroo Calendar. Order online from rangemagazine.com. Loving Liberty Network salutes the spirit of the American West at rangemagazine.com.
Well, my mom smokes and my dad smokes, and I saw them smoking, so I tried it. They're telling me not to smoke, but they smoke themselves.
When it comes to smoking, are you sending mixed signals?
But when you teach someone a certain way to do things and you go back on that certain way, it sends mixed signals to the person that they're trying to teach. The parents need to be the example.
Smoking. If you think you're old enough to start, you're smart enough to stop. A public service message from this station and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, Joe Lazito on your radio. His story is riveting. It's impressive. It's sad. You know what? It pisses people like me off because you go, you know what? How does this happen? I'm not talking about Joe and his fight and winning and stopping the thug. I'm grateful for that. We're talking about a New York subway hero, but after that, his life of how he's grateful and not angry and hate-filled and everything else is just impressive. His book is called The New York Subway Hero, My Battle with Evil and the Spree Killer, or A Spree Killer. It's on Amazon. It was written in 2014. Get your copy today. You can also check out his podcast called Coliseum Chronicles, The Penalty Box. Talking about enforcers that played for the New York Islanders. Anyway, Maxim Gelman killed four people before he slashed at Joe and ruined Joe's day, to say the least. But the unfortunate twist to this story, ladies and gentlemen, which I really want to focus on here, is that all this happened in full view of two uniformed police officers, what, NYPD?
Yes, sir.
Who sat there, watched the whole thing. After Joe got the guy stopped, and after the gentleman that helped him, what's his name again?
Alfred Douglas.
After Alfred Douglas helped Joe and everything else, then the cops came and said, hey, we got this. But what on earth is going on when the cops literally confronted this guy before he turned on Joe? When I say confronted him, I mean they talked to him and they rebuffed him from entering the motorman's cage, if you will. But yet, they didn't stop him. Now, these officers were on the train specifically to stop and arrest Gelman. But no. And they covered it up and they lied about the facts of the story. The problem is they're lying about the facts of the story didn't last long because the truth came out, right?
Yeah. So the first 24 hours, let's say, of the story, the only people that were speaking to the media were the police. I don't know if the officer himself actually spoke or if it was through police spokesman or whatever. And because I was in the hospital, so nobody had access to me. So the narrative that was out there the first 24 hours were just how heroic these police officers were. And then the next day, a reporter from the New York Daily News came to see me in the hospital. And it's funny because she really came in just to get my view of what happened and to talk about the police. And she basically said, tell me what happened right from the start. And I started telling her the story, and she got this look on her face and said, wait, you stopped him? And I said, yeah. And she said, well, that's not what the police are saying. And I said, I don't know what they're saying, but this is what happened. And her eyes got real big, and, you know, because now she's the first reporter that I'm speaking to. And, you know, even though it was 10 years ago, digital age is there, and she writes her story. Then the other newspapers hop on board, and it just took off like wildfire. So he was a hero for about 24 hours. And then when the truth came out, you know, I guess to their credit, the police and their union and the city stuck to their story. But I think the facts are just too much in your face to deny what happened.
And I don't know who's bigger scum, the guy with a knife or the cops that took the credit and covered it up, sir. But I don't mean to be offensive. I'm just saying I can't take this, Joe.
Well, listen, you know, to be honest, I've said the actual fight, the actual fisticuffs were easier than everything that I went through and my family went through afterwards, because You don't expect much from someone like Gelman, and he kind of lived up to expectations you have for him. But, you know, for someone like myself, who's been a law-abiding citizen my whole life and was raised that way, you kind of expect, so you expect the police to do their job, and these two police specifically that I'm speaking of, but then you kind of expect that you'll have your rights as a taxpayer, you'll have your rights as just a citizen, that you'll get your day in court. And I figured that they can tell all the lies they want. I'm just going to get them in court. And then I didn't even get that opportunity. I think it was just corruption in the highest order.
Well, and I get the cops maybe saying, I'm afraid, I don't want to get all sliced up. And, you know, let's just see how this thing unfolds. And if we have to, we'll take action. I'm not saying I agree with that. I'm just saying I can understand cowardice, right?
Yeah.
What I can't understand is that at the end, though, trying to take credit and spin the story, and then two, to cover it up like they did and try to play games with the facts, especially when they were the ones that were supposed to go in and stop this guy. I just don't understand that. Then what I don't understand even more so is, after all that, you would think, hey, the cops would be, you know, fired for dereliction of duty or whatever you want to call it. And, you know, the police force would go forward and have integrity and say, you know what, Joseph, you're a hero. We're so sorry about our police officers. We don't know what to say. Take the hit and move on. But no, they literally closed ranks. They literally had the courts, the media, everybody spin this in a way that doesn't make any sense, to the point where a Manhattan judge, so Joe did go to court, but he didn't get a fair day in court. There was not a proper due process of law, really. The Manhattan judge dismissed subway stabbing victim Joe Lozito's lawsuit against the NYPD. Basically said, hey, when two officers failed to aid him and protect him and everybody else on the train, for that matter, when they had every opportunity to, let's be very clear, then they dismissed the suit and said, you don't have any expectation of rights or protection from the cops?
Yes, and what she also said in the dismissal was she found my recollection of events highly credible. So to me, what that means is she believes everything I said, but she had to dismiss this case because the police have no duty to protect, and which caught a lot of people off guard. And I just want everybody to understand that You had started to allude to the fact that police are under attack in this country and everything, and I understand that it is true. But even after this, like I'm not anti-cop. I'm very proud to say my sister is a retired New York City police officer. My wife has cousins who are retired police officers on her side of the family. We have friends that are police officers. So in no way do I hold an entire police force to the fire because of the inactivity of two.
Well, and I agree with that, but I also say, though, that, you know what, it's the system that covers it up that is creating this rift between the police and the people, and that needs to stop. And so even now, I would hope that somehow we could get some kind of a redress of grievance for you on this and create accountability at somewhere.
Well, I definitely agree. I've said the system is broken 100,000 times since the day my case was dismissed. It is the system that needs to be changed. Well, what I've always said is, If I had my day in court and I lost, if I had my day in court and I won and my award in quotes was a dollar, I'm okay with that because I had my day in court and the system is doing what it's supposed to do. You know, it's easy for me to say because I know what the facts of the case are. And I know that there was no way I would have ever lost in court. And I would have loved the opportunity to get these officers on the stand and have them tell their recollection, because I think it was, I don't know who said it first, but I've heard Judge Judy say it a bunch of times, when you tell the truth, you don't need a good memory. And all the stories that were spun from that side, it seems like they'd have to remember an awful lot of stories. So, you know, when I tell my story, I don't have a script, it's just from memory. And it seems like they would probably have a little trouble recollecting all the lies that were told. And if I got them on the stand in a pressure situation, I don't like their chances.
Do you think it was attorneys? If you had better attorneys, you could have won. Do you think? What do you think on this thing? Can we go back and do anything about this?
I think my attorney did a great job. I think it was a case where from the first day that I went to his office, he told me exactly what their game plan was going to be. Was that they were going to go to court a couple of times. We were going to go through the discovery phase, and then they were going to make a motion to dismiss. where I think everything changed and where I think everything, the process was sped up, was my wife and I had an interview with the New York City, the insurance adjuster for the city. And it got to the point where after the interview, we called my lawyer back in the office and said, Jesus, this guy is the city's worst nightmare. And my lawyer said, what do you mean? And he said, well, first of all, he remembers everything. He's never been in trouble. He speaks very clearly, speaks very coherently. And, you know, you can just tell. And he goes, this guy is a nightmare for the city. And I think after that, that may have sped up the process of them trying to get the case dismissed. And, you know, like I always wonder, you know, what happens behind closed doors, behind the scenes. And, you know, maybe they got the right judge to kind of say, well, even though I believe everything he says, I'm going to just use old precedent. And if people read the book, I basically go over every case that they put in their motion to dismiss, and not a single one is similar to my case. So to me, they were grasping at straws, but I guess that's how the law works. It was definitely a David going up against Goliath, and I didn't stand a chance. As far as any recourse,
Goliath being the government and the cops and the courts, not Goliath being the knife man.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's why the title of the book is My Battle with Evil and the Spree Killer. To me, the evil is the government and the system that I went up against. Like I said, the fight.
But let's make it clear, the evil is the corruption in government, not the proper role of government as well.
Correct. Yeah. So it's basically everything I went through after the fact. And it was almost like getting attacked all over again. You know, I found out that my case was dismissed while I was at work one day. And wow. Then I didn't want to tell my wife over the phone. I didn't want to tell my kids over the phone. I had to digest that for a couple of hours before I went home. And then I had the 2.5 hour commute home. And then I had to bring that up to them. And it was just a nightmare. And I always say it was like getting attacked all over again. So I don't think I have any recourse. I think the statute of limitations is long expired. But there are a lot smarter people out there than I am when it comes to this stuff. And I'm always game to try to get something done if I did have any recourse.
Well, the important thing in my mind now is to highlight history so it never, ever repeats itself in this kind of a scenario, ladies and gentlemen, that they don't preserve their own above integrity for the American people and building trust with the people in whom they serve, etc. That, to me, is the most important piece of this. Where's Gelman now, and where are these cops now?
Gelman is in an upstate New York prison. He got... was sentenced to 50 years for each murder and 25 years for attempted murder of me. So he'll hopefully die in prison. Well, he definitely will die in prison as long as he doesn't escape, but hopefully sooner rather than later. I have no issue saying that. He's upstate New York. And the police, I assume Terrence Howell, who was the male cop there, he may even be retired by now. He had a lot of years on the force at that point, and it's been 10 years, so he could be retired. The other officer on the train, who was even more useless, Tamara Taylor, I think she was a lot younger. She's probably still on the force. So I always say, to add insult to injury, since I work in New York State and I work in New York City, my tax dollars go to keeping Maxim Gelman alive in jail and to help pay the salaries of the two officers who screwed me that day.
Well, these officers will have to live with that for the rest of their life, and what a penalty to pay. They know the truth, and they know honor, and they're going to have to live with the shame of that for the rest of their lives. On the other hand, Joseph can sleep at night peacefully with his lovely wife and knowing that he's got his family with him and he's got a life, thank heavens to God Almighty, and the MMA, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I always say, I guess it penetrated my brain through osmosis because... I don't know. Maybe if I don't watch it, I don't know what I do. But yeah, absolutely. Thank God for that.
I want to focus on this more, Joe. We've done 1 hour. We're flat out of time. I will get a hold of you later. There's more I want to do with this story, okay?
Anytime. Thank you so
Joseph,
much.
Joseph, thank you for your time, sir, and we're grateful you're alive. Tell your wife we're grateful for her. We know that it takes two to tango, and we know that a lot of your attitude and your way of looking at life is because of her. Thank her for me, will you?
Oh, definitely. Thank you, sir.
All right. Talk to you soon. There he goes, ladies and gentlemen. I'm telling you right now, a story that just makes you, on one hand, it makes you mad. On the other hand, it makes you grateful. Grateful for people like Joe. If we had a gazillion Joes in America, I don't think we'd be in the trouble we're in, ladies and gentlemen. Get his book now. Riveting story. The New York Subway Hero. My Battle with Evil and a Spree Killer. Came out in 2014. It's on Amazon. Ladies and gentlemen, this nation shall endure. God save the Republic of the United States of America.